So we're be ready to take questions and comments, and I would ask people to be brief and to the point, and if you are neither, I may interrupt you so that we move on and get as many people in as possible. So you ready?
Yes, please. Is this on? Yes, I think you can hear me. There is a website called nowpolling.ca, and the question of Medicare, whether the Medicare should be covered 100% by our taxes, or whether we should have partly paid by taxes and partly paid by clients or patients, or completely privatized. The question is there, and I encourage everyone here in this room tonight to go to nowpolling.ca. I have a little paper with the address there. If anybody wants to reach me after, I can give you the address here. But it's just now, like right now, polling, P-O-L-L-I-N-G, nowpolling.ca. Go there, register, and vote for the type of healthcare that you would like to have in Canada. Because what I do with that poll is show it to the politicians and tell them, this is what people want. This is our poll, and this is what we want. We don't want to limit ourselves to budgets for healthcare. If, as Colleen was saying, is a human right or is a social justice issue, we shouldn't limit ourselves to how much money do we have, whether we can afford to fix our legs or our diseases. But if it's a human right, then we shouldn't be discussing about whether we can afford it or not. We have to make clear that the NDP here in British Columbia understands that we want it 100% paid by taxes, and we shouldn't have to show any cards or anything other than go to a clinic, go to a doctor, and prove that we're sick. So now polling.ca, I have the paper, please come and see me after.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I just wanted to make a point. I know the Premier's conversation was alluded to, and I just wanted to let people know that he's actually launching his conversation tomorrow at BC Children's Hospital at 10:30 in the morning, and for people to check out what he's going to be saying about that. There's certainly a lot of deep concern that he's going to use this conversation to drive a privatization agenda. And I just wanted to encourage people to come to the table at the back, that we have letters to Premier Campbell demanding a real dialogue that the BC Health Coalition is collecting. So please, if you're interested, come to the back and sign a letter demanding a real conversation. And I just wanted to make another point about we're also currently doing a campaign on home support, which we think is a really good, positive way to both improve services and actually save money to the system. So if you're interested in more information about that, please come talk to us.
And this might add that the BC Health Coalition has really been leading the charge on trying to defend and expand the system.
More comments, not necessarily questions. I'm a healthcare person. Work in the operating rooms at VGH. Doesn't get too much bigger than that. One thing, I've been there for quite a long time, and one thing that I would desperately request that you add to the list of things that increase healthcare costs, and that is what I call the businessization of healthcare. The easiest thing to point to, as far as I'm concerned, is computerization of, you name it, everything. Everything centers around computers. But once the business community gets involved and does all their centralization and all the other nonsense that they congratulate themselves regularly on, sky high. We all know how regularly you have to get a new computer to keep up in your stereo system and all the other stuff, so that really increases costs a lot. Costs of technology that are difficult to evaluate, somehow practitioners themselves don't get asked. If you ask a general surgeon to compare the cost of a minimally invasive technique to remove a sick gallbladder or an appendix. Those are very easy things that, and the first things that were practiced on, but now we take out colons and spleens and all sorts of nonsense through this so-called minimally invasive surgery. Every single time, it's cheaper, because the biggest cost, I think, is hospital stay. There is a foot behind the patients, but the minute they step in the door, ready to kick them out as soon as possible, all the costs are decreased, with the exception of the initial investment in all of the equipment and stuff that's involved. And another thing that Mark mentioned about getting evidence as to whether new technological innovations truly work or not. In this country, they don't get used unless the proof goes out the door and down the street that it is a better way to do it. Practitioners are handcuffed from and prohibited from getting access to new ideas. Just because it's a new idea, it has to be proven with tons of evidence, et cetera, that it will save. Ultimately, what the government is interested in is saving money, but that's the most, it's pretty definitive. So it's a done deal in Canada, that's for sure.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Colleen.
Okay, I just wanted to add to that, you know, most of the, one of the things that is impacted by technology is the cost of drugs. And most of the drugs that are coming onto the market in Canada for the last 20 years, actually, are not new innovations in drug therapy. They're so-called Me Too drugs with a much, much higher price tag. I don't know what the situation is with all of the technology that's used in the hospital system. I know that there are major, major investments in technology. The private sector also makes huge investments in technology, and the cost of using the technology, if it's in the private sector, is going up, it's not going down. So because of all of the other pressures in the marketplace. But I think that that's a really important point. And one of the things that has just happened last week was the first step towards what is called a national pharmaceutical strategy. I don't know if people have had a chance to look at that, but it does include technology assessment at the national level. We have that at the Therapeutics Initiative at the University of British Columbia, which does do some limited technology assessment, mainly in the area of prescription drugs. But that has to be much more broadly used, because I think that the evidence on a lot of technology, as far as I'm concerned, is not conclusive. There is a lot of controversy, for example, even over the use of MRI technology, and what is the actual impact on health outcomes of this type of expensive technology, and is it, it's not that it's not worth the initial investment, but is it being overused, and we're not getting to the point that we need to get?
Okay.
Well, two things. For a public-private comparator, have a look at some pictures of Brian Day's gorgeous suite, and then look at the operating rooms in BGH.
Okay, thanks. Okay.
I attended a talk last fall from a speaker from the UN, and he put forth a startling statistic. Reflecting on yours, it's even more startling. What he said was that worldwide, mostly women from the ages, between the ages of 60 and 75, provide vast amounts more care than Now, Canada is a very wealthy country. I've listened to all three of you speak tonight. You've spoken about technology and costs. You've spoken about facilities and practices. But you haven't spoken much about care. For anyone that's gone the route of having a loved one or themselves within our healthcare system, they're well aware of the preening careerists who are running our health authorities under the thumb of those in the provincial government. They're also well aware of the increasing privatization via the doctors themselves who are, quote, independent contractors, or the various echelons of service providers. Many, and I would say in the majority of cases of the most lower paid, are from the very cultures that have extended family relationships and the type of caring that the rest of the world engages in. So when I hear people talk about Canada being a wealthy country, and I hear our healthcare professionals talking about our elders as mere market opportunities, and that includes our medical schools such as UBC, I think that Canada has a much bigger question when it comes to healthcare. I think when it comes to technology and facilities, it's much easier to sell version 2 than it is to fix and maintain a healthcare system that respects people. The fundamental challenge we face as the boomers retire will be the big surprise that we get when we learn that our healthcare system, especially residential care when it comes to elders, is founded fundamentally upon the penal system. I think our second speaker was very, very telling when she spoke about the inequities and prejudices in the commercial system. We need to build a healthcare system that also respects people from cradle to grave. We are failing. We do not have the checks and balances. For example, the 5,000 beds that were removed by the provincial government when the residential care system led, according to the former Assistant Deputy Minister Penny Bellum, to the deaths of the elderly and harm to families. And it must stop. I can tell you, our health authorities have no intention of stopping. Neither do our provincial government. That was a ploy simply to provide another market opportunity to privatize residential care to fill the gap.
I'm just going to stop you there and see if the panel has any comment on what you're saying there, if I may.
I can ask myself. Your comments, please.
Okay. Your remarks made me think of one. I'll just talk. So I'm on sort of a bit of a different tangent, Bruce Campbell, who's our national CCPA executive director, and I just released a report on deregulation in Canada. It's a huge federal effort right now to deregulate health and safety and environmental standards. No one's talking about it, but it's going on. They call it smart regulation. I think it's another one of these euphemisms like fiscal imbalance that they kind of throw out there all the time, and basically to divert most people. But in the course of doing that research, I discovered, and this is through the Canadian Cancer Society, that about 40%, 2 in 5 Canadians can expect to get cancer in their lifetimes, and 1 in 4 will die from cancer. Now, one of the reasons why that is the case, and there's growing evidence, is the fact that we have toxic chemicals like you wouldn't believe in our environment, in pesticides, in cosmetics, in consumer products, that in production processes. There's stuff that was, from production processes from that, even things that have been banned decades ago are still persistent in our environment, and they're causing these big problems. So that when we think about healthcare and what it's going to cost, we also need to take a big picture in terms of what this means in terms of prevention and precaution. And we need to take measures now that will prevent the huge costs we can expect in the future when it comes to our kids when they grow up and what they can expect to have in terms of their health outcomes purely on an environmental basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hello, Murray. Thanks. I liked your biography on Kim Campbell. That's what inspired me to go out and get rid of her. I hope you do another book on heartburn.
I don't think I can stomach it.
Marty, like for example, Campbell cut $1 million from the Suchi Institute for Alternative Medicine. Now, on the other hand, there are structural matters. Before I go on to that, just with MRIs, I get an MRI every year, and I want one to monitor my brain tumor, because I think it's a good idea, and also because I choose that particular neurosurgeon, and it's a fundamental principle that we have a right in Canada to choose our doctors, and somehow we have to maintain that, even though they're, you know, sort of small private. Now, on the structural matters, as far as regulation goes, there is a lot of deregulation, but there's a lot of regulation. For example, I go to the Compassion Club, and I get this marijuana tincture because it kills cancer. And it's legal to buy, the judges protect the storefront, but it's all grown illegally. So there's a form of real heavy regulation. For example, these acupuncture needles, since the NDP government initiated the regulation of acupuncture doctors, it's really technically illegal to do what Chinese people have done all their life, and that's put needles in their own family and friends. And it goes on and on, what they're doing with, the feds are doing with herbs, for example. They want to codify and regulate herbs. So if we hear about deregulation, we also have to remember that there is, well, a lot of new regulation, like they're going to try and get the intellectual property on herbs and stuff. One of the research projects into that would be into federalism, Colleen, because apparently the provincial government has the right to regulate things when they're provincially compounded, like put together here. So federalism into herbs might be an area of research. So what I'm getting at is, and other people have mentioned today, all kinds of structural matters besides the things that the NDP typically chases after is just budgetary matters. For example, on native property, the whole laws of the country to do with the regulation of health and the practice of health and so forth, well, you'd be breaking the law. There's 1,000 ways to break the law.
I'm just going to mention.
So I suggest, like for example, when I buy this marijuana tincture, the growers who grow it, I buy it legally on a commercial drive, the growers are breaking the law. So maybe we should start looking at structural things that we could get into some law breaking. If they don't want to give us cash, we'd be just moving to law breaking.
Okay, on that note, I'm just going to stop you there and see if the panel has any comment. You've covered a number of issues.
Well, in terms of the regulatory stuff, one of the things that should be, that I think needs to be regulated is, that you were talking about MRIs. I just want to make 2 points. One is that MRI...
Can you hear at the back? I'm just wondering if your mic's on. Okay.
MRI technology used in your particular case is one thing, but using MRI technology in cases where it's not necessarily appropriate and just costly, and this is what I'm talking about in terms of the technology that we're using. I'm not saying that MRI technology is de facto bad or any technology is bad, but it has to be used appropriately. And what we're seeing now are waiting times for knee surgery for people who are waiting not for the knee surgery but for the MRI scan of their knee when the physician isn't necessarily going to get any more information from the MRI scan than he or she would get from an x-ray of the patient's knee. I mean, this is really one of the problems that we're, or it's a question that is raised about the use of technology.
Your father's known me since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. And your father might say, well, x-rays are bad for health, MRI is not bad for health, and you need some more cash for the MRI machine.
So I just wanted to clarify that. In terms of regulation, I'm not going to say that I'm against regulation. In fact, I think that we are looking at a big problem with the lack of regulation, for example, of private surgical clinics. Doctors who work in those clinics are regulated by the College of Physicians and Surgeons, but the clinics themselves are not, they don't have as near the same regulatory rigor or the rigorous regulatory framework that governs hospitals. The private surgical clinics in the city of Vancouver are monitored by the public health officer in the same way that the public health officer monitors tattoo parlors. This is the private surgical clinics that are offering, you know, sophisticated surgery. I'm not saying that they're filthy and dirty. All I'm saying is that they're not regulated. The hospitals are regulated, the private surgical clinics are not.
Thank you. Yes.
I just want to make a comment about our healthcare system. Possibly every day you hear in the media we have a doctor shortage, you know, healthcare provision. In this country, there is a great pool of immigrant doctors, medical doctors around the world, which bring me back to announcement today. Actually, I'm an independent filmmaker. I've been working on this issue for the past 2 years. We completed a film. It's called Healthcare 911 just 2 weeks ago. It's going to be aired on Global National TV Current Affairs, hosted by Kevin Newman, this Saturday at 7 p.m. I hope all of you urge your friends and relatives to watch the film. If you feel you are outraged, call your elected official and demand accountability and change. Certainly, it's another dimension to how to expand our healthcare system. There is almost 8,000 medical doctors from some of the countries which their healthcare system is way better than us. So I hope all of you tune in September 30th, this Saturday at 7 p.m. at Global National TV, Channel 11. Thank you.
Great. And congratulations on getting that film produced.
I just want to respond to that in one sense, which is I think, you know, you're totally right. And, you know, the medical profession, like other professional associations, prevents immigrants from getting the credentials so that they can actually practice. Why? Because they're protecting their incomes. But I also think that too often the immigrants meeting our skilled labor demands is suggested as a solution. And to the extent it's a solution here, it's depleting countries from their skilled professionals and the money that their public sectors are putting into educating them. So I just want to be careful about where we go with that.
We have interviewed many people. Many of those people are coming from Iran. Their country has been destroyed, from Bosnia. Yes, Canada poaching doctors from other countries, but the reality is Canada losing 30% of their doctors to South Africa border each year. So you have to
replace that. That's not true.
That's true, actually. 70% of those people
30% of our doctors are. We wouldn't have any doctors left.
Sorry, 300 people just from British Columbia. I'm not sure about
the the flow of doctors to the United States was, I think it reached a peak in about 1998 or 1999, maybe 2000. But since that time, it has. The number of doctors going to the United States has fallen, I know the Fraser Institute likes to say that there's a brain drain to the United States, but in fact, that isn't the case. There's a great website called Canadian Health and Social something, anyway, I can't remember, but if you Google Mythbusters, healthcare Mythbusters, You'll get this newsletter that comes out periodically, and it explodes myths like the brain drain to the United States. I really urge people to go to that website. It's great.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, I know that Colleen talked about, you know, private health insurance, but it seems to me that, you know, one of the tactics and in all this talk about, you know, that we can't go on as we have been and everything, is this talk about, yes, we'll still pay for everybody, but we'll use the private providers. And I don't think I heard you guys talk about that. And that seems to me like that's such a sort of tactic that they're using to tell everybody, to calm everybody down. Don't worry, we'll all, everything will be covered. But, you know, it really is irrelevant whether it's covered by the private system or, you know, by publicly funded system. And it seems to me that that's a really important aspect of privatization and of what people are, you know, the privatizers are kind of gently saying, well, you don't really care, you just care that you're looked after, so why care whether it's private or not? And to me, I think that we do care and that's really important.
Well, it's that whole issue of language again, trying to soothe people and to, you know, don't worry, be happy. As long as you get service and the government is paying for it, it shouldn't matter. Well, it's absurd. I mean, it's like saying, well, as long as you get the quart of milk, it doesn't matter whether you pay $2 or $10. Actually, it does matter. And when you pay through a private service, you end up paying more.
Yeah, because they got to make a profit in there somewhere, right?
The biggest pushers for private insurance are actually the private surgical clinics in Canada, and the Canadian Independent Medical Clinic Association, CIMCA, which also has a website. It was founded by Brian Day and several other people, and since Brian Day is president-elect of the Canadian Medical Association, he stepped down as president of the association. But they were the organization that really helped push through the charter challenge in Quebec. I don't know if they're involved in the charter challenge in Alberta, but they certainly were involved. They organized people, enabled them to get intervener status in the charter challenge at the Supreme Court and so forth and so on. Private providers want private health insurance. That is the relationship I think that we need to take a look at a lot more closely, because private providers like a diverse source of revenue. They don't want to depend on one payer, they want to depend on multiple payers. And that's why they're pushing private insurance.
And I'd also add that as part of the whole framing of the healthcare conversation, the premier said, oh, well, you know, we should be looking to other models in Europe and innovations that they've brought in. That's okay, but the reality is what they're pushing is an American-style system. It's a North American market, it's integrated, the companies are the same crossing the border, and that's what they're pushing us towards. I mean, they can make references to Europe if they want, but only to the extent that it reinforces the direction they're pushing it.
I wanted to make a couple of comments. First of all, I really appreciated the ideas, the information, and the analysis that you presented tonight. I thought it really made a compelling case for public health care. And I was wondering if there was any way that we could send this panel around BC and across the country so that others could have the benefit of it. Secondly, I really like the notion of not only talking about our capacity to maintain our existing system, but to expand it. Mark mentioned perhaps to include dental care. I remember during the last provincial election when Gregor Robertson, who ran and was elected for the NDP, mentioned that his company, Happy Planet, provided dental care because that was something that was important to the health and welfare of his employees, and he thought it should be extended to all the citizens of British Columbia. And I think that we've been on the defensive in a way. We've been dealing with a group that's cutting back on the funding of health care and then defending a diminishing sort of service. And I think we'd have better luck if we went and said, look, we should be actually improving this, because then we'd be talking to people about making something that's already good better. Thank you.
Just before we take a repeat speaker here, somebody was just reminding me to mention the Speak Up events at the public library that are coming up. There is another one on healthcare, privatizing healthcare, the disease or the cure, which is Tuesday, October 24th here, and Thursday, November the 2nd at the Oak Ridge branch. I guess it's the same session in both places. And also, on another issue of great interest to Council of Canadians, water privatization. Next Tuesday at this library, on that one, is the glass half full or empty? And that session being repeated October the 11th at the Renfrew branch. And then finally, in November, there are a couple of sessions on does public space really belong to everyone? And another one on privatization in November on the 28th. And I think these brochures, I think we had some at the back, and people can take them, and then you can have it at the back. Ava has them. She's waving them. So anybody who's interested in following up on this really good series that the public library has produced there. Can I just take the person behind you who hasn't spoken yet before we have you repeat? Thanks.
I don't have deep thoughts on this whole matter. But it seems to me that the user of the public health system could be involved. For example, if we got a report on what we have used and the price of it every year, in this age of computers, would that be possible, realistically, just to make us aware of how we can restrain ourselves or perhaps not be quite as demanding. I'm not saying this well, but it just seems to me that there is room for public responsibility of the private user of the health system. I'd love you to respond to that.
And all of us?
Who wants to go first?
Mark?
I think it's an interesting question. I mean, in some areas, it's very difficult to gauge how much it actually costs. I mean, when you go into a hospital, I mean, they don't really sort of divvy it up in that way. I think that if you were to do that, it would be an interesting bit of information, but it would mean that people who earn a lot of money and therefore pay a lot of taxes would be pissed at how much they are paying to support all of these sick other people, and that it might, if anything, reinforce a push for more privatized forms of care. So I don't want to say we shouldn't have information or should be kept out of the public domain. We do have these sort of stats on a very broad aggregate level, but I am concerned that if you sort of got it on your form, then that might be the case.
I think it's a double-edged sword, too. Like, sometimes I think that if Canadians had a better understanding of the cost that is involved in even what the cost of premiums are on an annual basis in the private market, most people don't know actually what the full cost of private insurance is. And talking about Canadians. In the U.S., they have more knowledge about that, actually, because they have to deal with the private marketplace. They have to pay for everything. So sometimes I think that it would be good to impress upon Canadians what the consequences are of going down that private road. These are the real costs. On the other hand, I also really strongly believe that we have to reorganize healthcare totally. We have to put healthcare on the same basis as education, that it is not a social service in the same way that we have other social programs. It is a program like education, that you get it, you don't have to insure your kid to get your kid into the public school system, and you shouldn't have to insure yourself to get access to healthcare. It should be there for you. The cost is the cost to the taxpayer as a whole, not the cost to the individual. So I understand where you're coming from about that, because I think that Canadians are actually naive about the cost, that what cost they would have to carry if they were getting these services in the private sector. And I think that people are seduced into thinking the private sector is going to save everything. But when they get there, they're going to have a rude awakening because they've been so naive. But on the other hand, I think we should reorganize the healthcare system and just organize it like education. That's what Tommy Douglas wanted, and that's what I want too.
And the last thing is that one of the arguments that have been used for user fees is this notion that people overuse the system. And there might be a danger too in that that could fall into that trap and, you know, say that people are actually overusing it. And I don't think that that's the case except in very small numbers.
Mm-hmm. We'll take the last two people. Again, we'll take the man behind you first because he hasn't spoken, and then we'll give you your last chance.
Yeah, I think I recall at the very beginning of the system that we did get a return every year, a statement that the system had paid out this much on your behalf. It wasn't published in the papers. It was an individual statement that came when you, at the end of the year. I think I recall that. They did that for several years. I thought it was kind of interesting. I think it has some drawbacks that people that are already feel they're being overtaxed and all this kind of thing, they would use this sort of thing. So it's you can argue it either way. But one of the things I think that you say we reform the whole system, absolutely. But one of the things is to make use of the lower levels of the skills or whatever you call it. That's the wrong way to put it. But the nurse practitioners, people like this, I fell on the bus and I cut my head. It was nothing, but it was bleeding all over the place, you know. So I walked down there to the emergency. I waited about 4 hours, but a nurse could have sewn me up in the first 2 minutes. But no, I had to wait for the doctor, and they went through all kinds of rigmarole. I mean, it was nothing. I mean, I cut worse than that lots of times. Or you know, but it's just in your head and it bleeds all over the place. It looks terrible. But so that the nurse practitioners were giving injections. I had a friend that had twins. They had to go in and get some immunization or something. I know that the doctor charged twice for that. You know, that was put on two visits or two things anyhow, two items. The other thing too, I think that. So that I think you can broaden that. I saw that. I worked in Ethiopia for over a period of years, not steadily, but off and on. And the level of most of the stuff was done by practitioners and these certain people. And they were highly skilled. They were very, very good. They had checklists. And that was, I went down to them. I had a problem. I was peeing blood. But anyhow, which is sort of frightening. And I went to this place, and this was on the Kenya border, very isolated sort of place, and they had a place for pregnant women who from the nomads who were in that area, and it looked like a big sort of motel courtyard, and all these rooms, each one had a door, and it was almost entirely done by technicians, and the guy checked me out. He had a checklist, and he checked out all the things, and he said, oh, I know what's wrong with you. And he said that it's for, you're not drinking enough water and this sort of thing. This is a common problem in this area, and here's some antibiotics in case it gets infected. You'll be okay. So, you know, I walked out of there, but I'm sure here it would have been a big deal, and two visits, and, you know, come back for more, and have an x-ray, and all that sort of thing. But I think that overdoing. I have asthma, but it's not very bad. I've been had an asthma attack and ended up in the hospital twice, but only in the past 15 years, 20 years. And once I could feel something coming on, so I walked to the emergency here at Vancouver General. I walked from home to there, and I said, I feel this. The puffers aren't working, and I know what I need. I need a vapor. One of these vapor things I've had it before. No, they put me in a wheelchair. You can't budge out of the wheelchair. Couldn't find anybody to push a damn wheelchair. They finally got that. They took my clothes. I was in bed. They x-rayed me twice. This was an asthma attack. They x-rayed me twice. And finally, I escaped. And finally, 5:30 in the morning, and I was able to, I had to sign myself out. They didn't release me, you know? I mean, I suppose they spent $1,000 on me, you know, in one night. And I was oxygen all night. They brought the oxygen monitor thing. You stick your thumb in it or your finger. And he says, my God, your oxygen is down to almost nothing. I said, I've been on oxygen all night. Your machine doesn't work. So the idea of getting great care, we're not getting great care. It's overkill.
Okay, does anybody want to comment on that panel?
But there is one other thing, I think. Oh. That we can see there's right now in North America, and really in a large part of the world, there's a climate of fear. There's a climate of fear, and that goes through whether it's Medicare or whether the border guards should all be armed or any aspect of everything. We're on a war footing, and it's the climate of fear is worse than it was during the Second World War. I'm going to be a veteran, but not the best thing to do it. The climate of fear is far greater right now here than it ever was during the Second World War.
Okay.
And the every speech is made, especially in the United States, it builds this up. So I think that pervades all any argument or any issue that comes up. Everybody's sort of uptight. Or there's something really terrible going to happen.
Yeah, people get catastrophic about it.
Yeah. So whatever is happening is going to lead to doom. You know?
Right.
So I think that we have to pull back and consider what is happening in view of that sort of thing.
Okay.
Is this real, or are they trying to frighten the hell out of us?
Right, yes. Okay, I think Mari alluded to that. Colleen, you wanted to say something.
So I'm going to make 3 points. One, you made a really eloquent argument for multidisciplinary health care, where the doctor is part of the team and is not running the whole show in community-based health care clinics. Like that, we really need, BC has a horrible system of multidisciplinary community-based health care clinics, and we need more of them. The second thing is we've got to get doctors off the fee-for-service thing and put them on salary, whether they like it or not. To dump Stephen Harper. Stephen Harper is not, I really agree with what you said about this climate of fear. We will never fix the healthcare system as long as we're fighting in Afghanistan or mucking around somewhere else in the world, you know, bringing misery to other people. We will never fix the healthcare system here.
Okay. They want to wrap it up in the next 5 minutes, so can we be brief?
Yes. Yeah, like overusing naturopaths, for example. It was $10 the naturopaths got. And they, you know, they don't live on $10 visits. And that was cut. So, there was a mentioning about immigrants and healthcare. And this fellow was talking about how they do it somewhere else. One of the things I'd like to say is that when it comes to immigrants and healthcare, we've got immigrants coming in with under refugee status, under the independent point system status, under business class, under family sponsorship, marriage, skilled worker, even under NAFTA, various categories of immigrants. And when they get here, their documents are reviewed by the federal government as to their qualifications. And then when they get here, mostly it's the self-governing professions just put up walls because they want to control, well, they're like labor unions. And they don't want
labor unions want to increase their
managers. Well, they're big bad labor unions. They don't want the competition, and so that they give people a lot of trouble regarding their credentials. And this fellow was talking like these people in Ethiopia have a lot of credentials. So I think that's another problem that we need to look into.
Okay.
When it comes to immigrants and healthcare and having more practitioners who are skilled and qualified, we're just not letting them practice.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Addie, you're the last.
I have a little different slant on this whole health care. My health should be my care first. If I don't take care of my health first, it's my fault. If I still smoke and I end up in the emergency because I have a shortness of breath, I ought to be told to go home and quit smoking first. If I have a heart attack and I still end up eating at McDonald's 3 or 4 times a night, or a week, I should say, I should be told to do something about that first. Now, yes, I understand that there are problems and things come as you get older. That's when you need doctors, but it has to start with an individual first. You have to take care of your health first before you should have to rely on the healthcare system. It's my responsibility. It's good to have doctors, things go wrong, you know, there's accidents and stuff, but it should start with each and every one of us first. Take care of your health first, because your health is your responsibility, not the doctor's. You can go to the doctor, he can give you medication, but if you decide not to take it, well, that's because a lot of people do. My problem. Thank you.
Okay.
How are you going to know how to do that? Education.
Right.
As long as our education system is being dumbed.
Well, absolutely. That's why we have to educate ourselves. We talk about GE food these days. Well, everybody ought to be concerned about GE food because, yes, it is cheap to grow, but it ain't good for your health. You know,
but why is it always? But I mean, you put it all of the onus is on the individual. I mean, why shouldn't the governments be taking trans fats out of food and banning them? Why shouldn't we, you know, take
absolutely? Yes, it is our responsibility to make sure that the government does that. But it starts with us. We can't just sit back and say, well, why don't the government?
Well,
okay.
But it's sort of like saying, well, I as an individual, I won't have any toxic chemicals in my environment. Well, I can't control that. I mean, that is determined by decisions made all around. So I agree with you. Yeah, we should exercise, we should eat vegetables and that type of stuff. But there's so many factors that drive
absolutely.
Health problems, and a lot of them are environmental.
I'm not saying it's an easy problem. I absolutely agree with you. It's not an easy problem, but we have to start somewhere. And we have to start, you know, to make sure that the government realizes that all this problem with GE foods and the preservatives, etc., has to stop. It is my responsibility to do that. Not yours. It is my responsibility. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, I think we'll wrap it up. I want to thank the members of our panel very much for their provocative, interesting, learned presentations, and thank you for being here and participating in the discussion, and we'll hope to see you at other council events.